Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Candace. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop, Living with Triple-Negative Breast Cancer. And today's program will be focusing on Living with Triple-Negative Breast Cancer, update on Triple-Negative Breast Cancer, so really the medical updates on Triple-Negative Breast Cancer. And today's program is really a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, and I really want to thank them for their collaboration with us on this program today and their support, very generous support of the program today. Today's program is also, we have many other cancer organizations that are actually helping to spread the word about this program, and this also being Breast Cancer Awareness Month, there are a number of breast cancer organizations as well helping to let you know about the program. And because of all of that outreach about the program, we have over 624 participants on the program today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Costa Rica, Switzerland, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it really is a credit to all of you that you have chosen to spend the next hour with us. And today is part one of a two-part series, so I'll tell you more about the second part at the end of the program. Today's program is supported by the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, and additional support is provided by AbbVie and Celldex Therapeutics. And I really want to thank them all for their collaboration in making this program possible and their partnership as well. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Shannon Puhala. Dr. Puhala is Director, Breast Cancer Clinical Research Program, McGee Women's Hospital of UPMC, Women's Cancer Center, and she's Assistant Professor of Medicine, University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And Dr. Puhala will be addressing an overview of triple-negative breast cancer, current standard of care, as well as new and emerging treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Puhala.
Hi, Carolyn. Thank you very much, and I really appreciate the chance to be able to speak with everyone today over such an important topic with triple-negative breast cancer. So with that, it's, you know, we have 10 minutes, which is something I could generally talk for hours about, but to limit it to 10 minutes, we'll talk just very briefly about what is triple-negative breast cancer. And really, it's a definition of default in that triple-negative tells us what the cancer is not, but it doesn't really tell us what the cancer is. So triple negative means that the cancer is not estrogen receptor positive, is not progesterone receptor positive, and is not HER2-new positive. So when we talk about triple negative, that means that it's negative for those three things. Within triple negative disease, though, there is a lot of heterogeneity, and this is something that we are just starting to learn more and more about in terms of understanding the biology of triple negative disease. So with that, some things that we'll talk about and that are not entirely synonymous with triple negative is this idea of basal or basal-like breast cancer. That's a subtype, if you will, or molecular subclassification of triple-negative disease. Some of those who are in the audience today may have heard about the Vanderbilt subclassifications of triple-negative breast cancer, and that was a way to further define these different subtypes of triple-negative because it's not all the same as one would imagine. So when we think about further subclassifying triple-negative breast cancer, we can think of it as subclassifying into basal-like, immunomodulatory, so those are triple negative for which the immune system may be particularly relevant, mesenchymal, stem cell-like, luminal or androgen receptor-like, or unclassified. So as we talk more about what's going on from a research standpoint, these different subtypes may come into play. Now, this is not something that's ready for prime time now, so it's not a test that we can order for patients on a daily basis, but this is something that's being done in the laboratory to help to better define and ultimately potentially better treat triple negative disease. So what I'd like to talk about first is early stage triple negative disease. So these are patients who are generally diagnosed either by physical exam or hopefully by mammography in an early stage. So early stage meaning stage 1 or stage 2 or stage 3. And with triple negative disease, one of the things that you will often hear about is whether or not to give treatment prior to surgery, and that's something that we call neoadjuvant treatment. So in most circumstances for patients with triple negative breast cancer, they will need to receive chemotherapy in some way. So with that, in many circumstances, we will consider giving chemotherapy prior to their surgery. There are a couple advantages to doing that. One advantage is that we can downstage the cancer, and for a woman who is perhaps looking at a mastectomy as her only treatment option, or a woman who is looking at a large lumpectomy as her only treatment option, this is a way to shrink the tumor down in order to preserve breast tissue. There are some other rationales to consider neoadjuvant treatment, and one of those rationales is that we can actually see how well the cancer is responding. And we also know that depending on how well the cancer responds to the chemotherapy, that can help to determine long-term prognosis. So there's a definition that I'll give you, something called PCR, or pathologic complete response. And what that means is that when a woman or a man is undergoing chemotherapy prior to surgery, at the time of surgery, there is no cancer left in the breast. And why that is important is because those patients who are able to have a pathologic complete response to chemotherapy, their long-term outcome is very good. So what about those patients who do not have a pathologic complete response? Well, that's an important group of patients as well, and there are some ongoing international studies and a large national study that is looking at what can we give those patients to better improve their outcome over the long term. So in terms of treatments that we give in early stage patients, generally patients will receive some combination of anthracycline type drugs. So these are drugs like adriamycin or doxorubicin in combination with a taxane type drug. So these are drugs like paclitaxel or docetaxel. And some combination of these two big classes of drugs is the standard of care. There's a recent study presented at our national ASCO meeting that again showed that those patients who receive both an anthracycline and the taxane, that the group who has the greatest benefit to that combination is triple negative disease. There are different ways to give this. Sometimes you'll hear of something called dose-dense chemotherapy, which is shortening the time in between the chemotherapy cycles. There is some evidence that this could be helpful or more helpful for those patients with triple negative disease. And in many cases, we will look at giving the taxane drug, paclitaxel, once a week. So that would be considered a current standard for patients with early stage disease. Again, this can either be given before surgery or after surgery, and there are some specific rationales to consider it in some circumstances before surgery. So where we are right now from a research standpoint with patients with early stage disease, one of the big unanswered questions is the role of platinum chemotherapies in patients with triple negative disease. And platinum drugs, they can either be carboplatin or cisplatin, but these particular chemotherapy drugs damage DNA in a specific way that we think some triple negative breast cancers may be more susceptible to. Now, these are very old chemotherapy drugs. They've literally been around for 20 or 30 years, and they were looked at in breast cancer in the very early days of chemotherapy, but that was really before we understood breast cancer to be made up of separate diseases. So what we have learned within the past couple years with triple negative disease, there were two medium-sized clinical trials, or what we would call phase two clinical trials, that showed advantage to adding platinum chemotherapy to the standard adriamycin or doxorubicin in taxane-based therapy. And what those agents specifically appeared to do is improve that pathologic complete response rate, or improve the number of women who were able to not have any cancer left in the breast after chemotherapy. And on average, that was improved by about 10 to 15%. So say, for instance, if the standard pathologic complete response rate is about 40%, maybe that would go up to about 50% with the addition of platinum. Now, the caveats to that are is that those were large studies, but they were phase two and not definitive. So there was some other large studies that are being done, both in the neoadjuvant setting. A study has been completed, and there's an ongoing study in the adjuvant setting, because what we'd like to learn is, do we need to add platinum agents to every patient with triple-negative disease, or perhaps there's a specific subset of triple-negative disease who will benefit most? So speaking of subsets of triple-negative disease, there is a proportion of patients who have triple-negative breast cancer who will also have a BRCA or BRCA gene mutation. And particularly with BRCA1, many of those patients will have triple-negative breast cancer. That is a group of patients as well that has been looked at in terms of response to platinum chemotherapy. And this is really borrowing from all the data we have in patients with ovarian cancer who have BRCA mutations, for which we know there is a lot of efficacy to platinum. So when we talk about platinum and triple negative, there's data that specifically the BRCA population of triple negative disease may be even more sensitive to these platinum agents. Again, this is something that I encourage patients who have BRCA positive triple negative cancer to discuss with their physicians about if there is potentially a role. Now, this is not definitive by any means, but this is something that's emerging and that sometimes patients will be treated with these agents. Now, another recent study that was important in this patient population is, again, what to do for these patients for whom chemotherapy is not entirely effective for their cancer. There was another large study that was presented, something called CREATE-X, and that study looked at a chemotherapy drug. The brand name is Zolota. The other name for this drug is capecitabine. This is an oral chemotherapy drug, and in this study, patients who received the anthracycline and the taxane, who then had cancer left in the breast at the time of surgery, went on to receive a number of cycles of this capecitabine drug, and it did show a benefit in terms of reducing the risk of recurrence of disease and also in improving the overall survival. So with that, the greatest benefit in that study was specifically in patients with triple negative disease. Now, a number of unanswered questions. We do know that there is some differences in drug metabolism and in cancer in general between Eastern population. So this particular study was done in Korea compared to more Western, whether American or Western Europe population. So there are some differences in terms of drug efficacy and drug metabolism. So that's one potential issue. Zolota has been looked at in other clinical trials and has not shown this degree of advantage. This is somewhat of an unanswered question, although there are some circumstances where you may be approached by your physician to consider this. And there's actually a large clinical trial that is being done by a group called ECOG, the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, that is open at many centers throughout the country, which look at taking patients and randomizing them to receiving platinum-based chemotherapy or this capecitabine or Zolota-based chemotherapy if they have cancer left in the breast after surgery. So that's an important population. Briefly, in the amount of time we have left, I would like to switch and talk about advanced. So these are patients who have metastatic or stage 4 triple negative disease. In terms of natural history, this generally occurs within 1 to 3 years after the original diagnosis, and then after that point, the incidence drops off very, very precipitously. There are a number of standard chemotherapy drugs that we have available. One area that we are particularly interested from a research standpoint is the idea of immunotherapy or immune therapy for specifically triple negative. The reason why we think this may be even more important in triple negative disease is that there are a number of features in triple negative disease that may predict for response to immune therapy. One of those is something called tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, or TILs. This is when the pathologist looks at a breast cancer sample and can actually see immune cells already in the breast cancer. There's also some evidence that there are certain proteins expressed in triple negative compared to non-triple negative disease that may select for responses to immune therapy. And you may have heard about these drugs, particularly in lung cancer and melanoma or in bladder cancer. There's been a big splash with immunotherapy. So where we are right now in triple negative disease is we do have some early, and by early I mean phase one, clinical trial data with immune checkpoint inhibitor drugs in triple negative disease. One of these drugs you may have heard of is a drug called pembrolizumab. As a single agent, the response rate is about 20%, and there are some patients for whom the responses are very durable. There are some other immunotherapy drugs. Another drug is avelumab. There's a third drug called atezolizumab. These have all been studied in triple-negative disease. I think what we can say at this point with very early clinical trial data is that there is some response to these drugs as a single agent. It's not as high as we would like. There is some data that combining immune checkpoint inhibitors with chemotherapy may actually be more effective. So there is a number of ongoing trials, whether you discuss with your oncologist or go to clinicaltrials.gov, there's likely to be something that is a potential option for you or something that you can find. And very lastly here, as I finish up, I would like to mention the androgen receptor. This is a receptor that's important in patients with prostate cancer, but has also been shown that about anywhere ranging from 12 to 50% of triple-negative breast cancers will also overexpress this receptor. And there are some clinical trials actually looking at drugs that we use in prostate cancer to treat these types of triple-negative breast cancer. So I think the take-home point is we're learning more and more about the specific subtypes of triple-negative disease, and there are a number of clinical trials that are ongoing in this pathway. We have a lot of standard agents available, typically in the form of chemotherapy. So I think I've exceeded my 10 minutes here, so I'm going to go ahead and stop, but I will be happy to answer any questions at the end of this call. Thank you.
Oh, Dr. Pahala, much appreciated by our participants and really very informative. And I know there'll be lots of questions to you during the Q&A, but you really have covered a lot of very significant points for people, and I know there'll be more questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Lisa Newman. Dr. Newman is director of the Breast Oncology Program for the Multi-Hospital Henry Ford Health System and founding medical director for HFHS, International Center for the Study of Breast Cancer Subtypes. And Dr. Newman is going to address the role of surgery, clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, and the follow-up care plan. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Newman.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to join everybody today. So surgical planning for triple-negative breast cancer actually follows the same principles as those that we adhere to when we are coming up with a treatment plan for a woman with a non-triple-negative breast cancer. And those principles fall into three different categories. The first principle that has to be addressed is that we need to remove the obvious area of disease. This is important for breast cancer patients, just as it's important for patients with colon cancer, and this is the reason why the vast majority of breast cancer patients need to have some surgery as at least one component of their care. Now, the second principle is a little bit more specific or unique to cancers that we identify in a woman's breast. The second principle is that we need to treat the entire breast as an organ. Treating the entire breast is important because we know from the many, many decades when mastectomy was the only treatment available for breast cancer patients, we learned that when we look at those mastectomy breast specimens carefully enough in the laboratory after they've been removed, you can actually find microscopic areas of cancer in totally separate parts of the breast compared to where the primary cancerous lump was identified and biopsied. So it's only logical that you want to make sure that you've done anything and everything necessary to reduce the chances that those other hidden areas of disease will continue to grow and progress into other cancerous lumps. These first two principles guide our treatment planning in terms of surgery for the breast itself. And we have, again, mastectomy as the oldest form of treatment and surgery for breast cancer. And therefore, when we do a mastectomy, we are basically taking care of these first two principles in one fell swoop. The alternative to mastectomy is breast conserving or breast saving surgery, where we perform a lumpectomy to remove that obvious area of disease where the cancer was identified and biopsied. And if the lumpectomy was successful, meaning that we've removed the entire cancer with what we call negative margins, and we don't see any evidence of cancer cells at the surfaces of the lumpectomy specimen, then we treat that remaining saved breast with radiation. And radiation is very, very effective at killing those hidden areas of cancer in other parts of the breast left behind after the lumpectomy. Survival from breast cancer, whether it's triple-negative breast cancer or non-triple-negative breast cancer, is exactly the same regardless of whether the woman chooses the mastectomy surgery or the breast-conserving surgery, lumpectomy and radiation. And survival is exactly the same because for breast cancer, what determines survival is going to be the risk of the cancer hiding in other parts of the body, other organs such as the liver, lungs, bones, and potentially damaging those other organs over long-term follow-up. Whether the woman chooses to save her breast or not will not affect that risk of distant organ spread or distant organ metastatic disease. Now, the third principle of breast cancer treatment, whether it's triple negative or non-triple negative, is staging of the cancer by evaluating the lymph nodes of the underarm area, which is typically done through a procedure that we call the sentinel lymph node biopsy. And with a sentinel lymph node biopsy, we are identifying and removing the most important lymph nodes or glands that are responsible for draining that patient's breast and therefore her breast cancer. And usually the sentinel lymph nodes of a breast cancer patient will be located in the armpit or the axilla of that cancer patient. Removing those sentinel lymph nodes and then analyzing those sentinel lymph nodes under the microscope gives us ideas about how extensive the cancer is. If we find that there are microscopic cancer cells hiding in those sentinel lymph nodes, then that's a very powerful clue that the woman might have microscopic disease hiding in other organs, such as her liver, lungs, bones, and it helps us to give the patient a better prognosis. It helps us to give the patient clues about how likely it is that her cancer will be successfully treated. And most importantly, it gives us clues regarding whether or not chemotherapy will indeed be important in treating that cancer, because chemotherapy is very effective at killing microscopic disease hiding in other organs. So checking those lymph nodes, the third principle of surgical planning for breast cancer, is very important regardless of whether the woman chooses the lumpectomy surgery or the mastectomy surgery. Now, for those women who choose to have a mastectomy because that happens to be their personal preference, or for those women who need to have a mastectomy because we find out that there are clues related to the extent of the cancer in the breast such that a lumpectomy and radiation are not appropriate, in those circumstances, we always try to make sure that the patient meets with the plastic surgeons to evaluate the reconstruction options. A lot of breast reconstruction for mastectomy patients can be done at the same time as the mastectomy, and this is what we call immediate breast reconstruction. But the door is never closed to reconstruction. Some women will undergo the mastectomy surgery and then have the breast reconstruction in a delayed fashion months or even years after the mastectomy has been performed. The reconstruction also does not affect the patient's survival outcome. So we do try to encourage breast reconstruction whenever it's feasible. Now, as you heard this explained very eloquently by Dr. Pohalla already, chemotherapy for triple-negative breast cancers is very often necessary. Chemotherapy is very often necessary for triple-negative breast cancers for two reasons. For one thing, triple-negative breast cancers unfortunately tend to be biologically more aggressive, inherently more aggressive compared to non-triple-negative breast cancers. And as Dr. Pohalla already explained, triple-negative breast cancers mean by definition that these tumors are negative for the three biomarkers that typically identify patients that can receive targeted therapy for their breast cancer, targeted therapy being hormonal or endocrine treatments that are appropriate for estrogen receptor and or progesterone receptor positive breast cancers, or targeted anti-HER2-new therapies. If the cancer is triple negative and negative for the ER, PR, and HER2-new marker, then general chemotherapy is what is going to be necessary to treat the microscopic amounts of cancer hiding in other organs, again, such as the liver, lungs, bones, what have you. So triple-negative breast cancers tend to need chemotherapy more frequently. Because triple-negative breast cancers tend to need chemotherapy more frequently, it becomes very frequent to consider the option of switching the typical sequence of treatment, that typical sequence being surgery first, followed by chemotherapy, and consider the option of neoadjuvant or preoperative chemotherapy. So this is where Dr. Pohalla was very appropriately describing the advantage of downstaging a tumor that's relatively large in order to improve a patient's lumpectomy eligibility. There are other reasons why a patient may consider receiving chemotherapy before she actually has her definitive surgical management for that triple-negative breast cancer. It's very common for triple-negative breast cancer patients to find out that they have inherited predisposition for breast cancer by carrying a mutation in the BRCA1 gene. And so if a patient undergoes chemotherapy before she has her surgery, it might give that patient time to undergo genetic counseling and genetic testing to determine whether she is or is not, in fact, positive for a BRCA1 mutation. And if that patient does end up having a BRCA1 mutation, it might motivate the patient to pursue more aggressive surgery for prevention purposes, such as bilateral or the double mastectomy surgery. Some patients are simply ambivalent regarding whether they prefer breast-saving surgery or mastectomy surgery, and so they opt for undergoing chemotherapy as the first step simply so that they can have more time for making that surgical decision. Now, I do want to emphasize the importance of early detection even when a woman has one of these cancers called triple-negative breast cancer that, again, tend to be biologically more aggressive. If a triple-negative breast cancer is caught at a very early size and the nodes are negative, then that patient might not necessarily need to receive chemotherapy. So early detection is critical. If the triple-negative cancer is caught at a very small size and the lymph nodes are negative, the patient might be better off being treated by surgery first so that we can obtain the definitive surgical pathologic staging information and make more sound decisions regarding whether or not chemotherapy should come into the picture at all. So if there are concerns or questions regarding the need for chemotherapy, then surgery should always be the first step. Now, shifting gears to discuss clinical trials again, you heard about some wonderful research going on in the medical oncology arena regarding clinical trials for different chemotherapy approaches in triple-negative breast cancer. There are other clinical trials for triple-negative breast cancer that are related to other modalities of treatment for the disease. One trial in particular is looking at the value of breast magnetic resonance imaging to help decide which patients are better candidates for lumpectomy surgery, for breast-conserving surgery. And there is a clinical trial ongoing on a national level by the Alliance Clinical Trial Cooperative Group, where women are, if they have a triple-negative breast cancer, they are eligible to participate in this clinical trial, and these women are then randomized to either receive a breast MRI prior to surgery or to not receive a breast MRI prior to the surgery. And if the woman is randomized to receive the MRI, then the findings on that MRI might determine whether or not the patient is a good or a bad candidate for the lumpectomy, for the breast-saving surgical approach. Now, it might seem on surface that doing an MRI would be a very valuable way of identifying a lumpectomy candidate, but we actually don't know that to be the case. It's possible that MRI is so exquisitely sensitive in identifying microscopic areas of cancer in a woman's breast that an MRI in the setting of a woman who has a known cancer might actually be showing you the areas of cancer that would have been killed by the radiation after a lumpectomy. And so this is why the Alliance MRI trial is so very exciting in helping us to determine definitively whether or not we should or should not be doing MRIs routinely for our newly diagnosed breast cancer patients. Lastly, I want to just talk about risk factors for triple-negative breast cancer, the big ones being having a known hereditary susceptibility, being a known BRCA1 mutation carrier, and by having African ancestry. African-American women and women from the continent of Africa has a higher incidence of triple-negative breast cancer, and there is a lot of active epidemiology and precision medicine research going into trying to sort out why this is the case and whether or not there are some specific markers associated with African ancestry that might allow us to identify women who are at higher risk for triple-negative breast cancer. And lastly, I want to emphasize once again the importance of early detection. Regardless of whether a woman has a diagnosis of triple-negative breast cancer or non-triple-negative breast cancer, identifying that cancer when it is at a small size and an early stage is associated with the best likelihood of successful treatment. And I thank everybody for their time and attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Newman. That was really excellent and really very comprehensive. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira. Dr. Shapira is Associate Professor of Medicine, Stanford School of Medicine, Director, Cancer Survivorship Program, Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Shapira is going to address managing treatment side effects and pain, including neuropathy, communicating with the healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Shapira.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, for the opportunity and for the gracious introduction. It's a pleasure to be with all of you. The first approach I'd like to discuss with you is how you can prepare for the visit with your cancer care team. And perhaps the first question we should ask ourselves, or you should ask yourselves, is who is in that cancer team? Increasingly, we practice medicine in the cancer setting in teams that are multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary, meaning that there are different people with different roles and different areas of expertise. So it's important to think of communication with each individual professional, but also with the team. Communication really involves give and take. So the better prepared you are, the more strategic you can be in your communication, perhaps the better supported you'll feel. It's important to be informed, and we're all for having patients who are informed, but it's important to select the source of information very carefully. Preparing by doing internet searches and so on is great, but make sure the information that you look for is credible and vetted by experts. That is definitely available thanks to the efforts of organizations such as the American Society of Clinical Oncology, ACS, NCI. So familiarize yourself with good, reliable, credible, trustworthy sources of information. Another practical tip is that it always helps to have somebody with you when you go for visits. You may not be feeling very calm. You may be a bit anxious. It may be hard to remember everything that's said. So having somebody with you typically means that more questions are asked, more information is being exchanged, and then may give you the opportunity to debrief after the visits. You may be unprepared for what is actually discussed. You may think that you understand the entire situation, but perhaps you're given an opportunity to participate in a trial, or perhaps you are presented with some information that you don't quite understand or didn't quite expect. So having somebody with you is really important. And then really trying to be as calm and prepared as possible and ask questions. Take notes if you need to. Record conversation, go back to it, and ask who in the team is available to take your questions. Typically what happens is that questions occur in the middle of the night or many hours after the actual meeting or a consultation, so it's important to have a mechanism established ahead of time for knowing who you can contact and how to perhaps ask your questions. Some teams will encourage you to do this via email. Others will not accept emails and may prefer to have you call. Remember that if you call, your call may not be answered immediately. So be prepared, make a plan, and discuss this in advance. And very important also to try to have somebody who can support you and attend these meetings with you. A lot of what gets discussed has to do with treatment options, and these days most clinicians really value and want patients to weigh in when there are choices that need to be made. So be prepared to be consulted. But again, in order to be a good participant in decision-making, often you need to be both informed and also calm enough so that you really can weigh your options and think about the consequences of choosing one form of treatment perhaps over another. This impacts on all of the dimensions of what we call quality of life. So there's a physical dimension to quality of life, and we typically think of that as the things that we feel in our bodies, whether we're getting enough sleep, whether we have enough energy, whether we suffer pain or nausea or hair loss. But there are also other dimensions of quality of life that have to do with how we cope and our emotions. We may be very calm, or you may find that you are crying daily or feeling very distressed or even having intrusive thoughts and fears, and those really need to be communicated and addressed. There may be existential or spiritual concerns associated with living with cancer or having a cancer diagnosis or undergoing some very traumatic or difficult treatments. And here, too, it's important to try to think about this and ask for help from members of the team. There must be somebody in the team who is ready to reach out and listen and help connect you with the sources of support. And then when we think about quality of life, there also is the social dimension, and that, in my way of thinking, has to do with all of the roles that we typically fulfill in our normal lives. Many of us take great pride in our professional accomplishments or the ability to be a parent and drive our children and participate in their lives in so many different ways, and many perhaps have volunteer activities with in communities or faith-based activities, and in many ways, living with cancer will impact on your energy stores and perhaps your ability to perform in all of those different roles. So these, all of these issues affect how you feel, and all of these issues really matter when we think about quality of life. If you feel very good about your entire situation and you feel hopeful and optimistic, perhaps you will be better able to tolerate some of the physical discomfort. But if you're feeling distressed or perhaps very fearful, even the slightest physical symptom, like some perhaps a small amount of nausea, may overwhelm you and make you feel that you need some help and some assistance coping. So it's important to try to be as calm as possible, as informed, as prepared, and also to establish ways of letting others know when you need help. And the help may be help with a physical symptom, such as nausea or lack of appetite or pain, but it may also be emotional distress. So with that, let's turn to some of the symptoms. We often talk about managing symptoms, and that is because, unfortunately, not only does the cancer lead to some concerns both in the physical and emotional arenas, but also the treatments we use for cancer have with them very unpleasant, disturbing side effects. So platinum drugs were mentioned. They are very effective in dealing and treating with triple-negative breast cancer, but platinum also is a major offender in terms of causing nerve damage. This is called neuropathy, and it can be experienced as tingling or lack of sensation. Sometimes it's experienced as very acute and uncomfortable sensations that are painful or bordering on pain. Sometimes these very disturbing and unpleasant sensations persist for many months or even years, even after the treatment has ended, and sometimes they require treatment. But these are the kinds of things that you need to, if you are the patient or your loved one is a patient, you need to openly discuss with members of the healthcare team, because they may not be immediately visible or measurable to them. So neuropathy, for instance, is a very common and distressing side effect of treatment. There are pharmacologic interventions. There are drugs such as gabapentin, pregabalin, and perhaps the most effective drug is duloxetine that can be used in addition to other non-pharmacologic methods. but there may be other side effects. There may be side effects related to loss of sleep, emotional changes as a result of not feeling well. Fatigue is often a very common side effect of cancer treatments, and it's described as being different than just being tired. It's a very unpleasant sensation. And often, again, there is no very good, no easy fix for this, or no easy timeline to think about. So it's important also to address this with the team and to think about ways and mechanisms for pacing oneself and trying to conserve energy and perhaps to find ways, again, with medications or with perhaps some psychosocial interventions that help one to get as much rest as possible to counteract this very unpleasant, difficult sensation. There could be other sources of pain. Some women may have pain post-biopsy or post-operatively, and in some cases that pain persists. There could be other unpleasant side effects ranging from hair loss to nausea, vomiting. So all of these things, I think, are things that one unfortunately needs to expect as part of the burden of symptoms that come with treatment. But one has to also try to keep an eye on the ultimate goal of treatment, which is to get rid of cancer and preserve life and, in the long haul, improve quality of life. So my advice to everybody, whether you're going through cancer treatment or a loved one, is to prepare, to be calm, to take notes, to look for credible information, and to have a good, fluid relationship with different members of the healthcare team, so that you find that they're not only treating the cancer, but also looking after your needs in the best possible way. And don't forget the incredible role of getting social support, and that's something that I'm sure we'll hear more about in the rest of the conference. Thank you, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Shapiro. That was really wonderful. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Haley Dinneman. Ms. Dinneman is a lawyer. She's co-founder and executive director of Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation. And I have to say, I want to thank again them for their generous support of this program and for their also support of many other initiatives here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Dinneman will address the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation. So it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Haley.
Thank you so much for the introduction, Carolyn. I want to take a moment to thank our partners at Cancer Care and my fellow presenters for the excellent overview and updates on triple negative breast cancer. Today's webinar and teleconference is one of so many programs offered by the foundation. All our programming is specifically designed to address the needs of the triple negative community, from patients and survivors to caregivers and loved ones. So today I'd like to highlight a few of our programmatic offerings, and I sincerely hope that you'll take advantage of them as you navigate from diagnosis through treatment and finally to survivorship. So first, we have numerous educational brochures that are available in print or also as free downloads from our website. Our popular Understanding TNBC brochure and our recently released treatment guide for patients and their families were developed with input from members of our TNBC community, as well as esteemed medical experts in the area of TNBC. These brochures, as well as all of the other educational materials we offer, have special sections addressing issues of particular interest to certain members of our TNBC community, including African American and Latina women, those with BRCA mutations, those with early stage diagnoses, and of course those with metastatic disease. We work really hard to make sure that every member of our TNBC community can find relevant information and practical guidance in these materials, so I hope you will use them to your benefit. Our website, tnbcfoundation.org, also offers a TNBC-specific clinical trials matching service, a constantly updated TNBC news section, and a favorite of many in our community are the online discussion forums. These forums allow you to easily connect with women who are living with triple negative breast cancer any time of the day or night. Our community, which includes thousands of women from those who are newly diagnosed to many long-term survivors, use the forums to ask questions about treatment, about how to manage side effects, and anything else related to triple negative breast cancer. but most importantly, our discussion forums offer consistent support. So if you aren't currently registered for the forums, you should consider joining them. You can even join anonymously, and I can't stress enough how helpful they've been to so many women. Of course, if you'd prefer to benefit from more of an in-person meeting, I hope you'll consider joining us next fall for our conference weekend. The TNBC Foundation partners with Living Beyond Breast Cancer every year to provide you with specific triple negative programming. We recently returned from our latest conference weekend in Philadelphia, which many of you attended, and our next conference won't take place until next fall, but it's never too early to start planning. So if you're interested, please look out for information about the program. In the meantime, I hope you'll join us as we begin planning our programming for our national TNBC Day campaign. Beginning on March 3rd and lasting throughout the month of March, we'll once again roll out our campaign to increase awareness of triple negative breast cancer, to provide our community with opportunities for education and support, and to support fundraising efforts for TNBC-specific research. So many of you on this call have been supporting this TNBC Foundation-led effort for years, planning and executing wonderful events and email campaigns every March. I want to thank you for helping us spread the word. And just like in past years, I'm so proud to be able to say that 100% of the funds raised by members of our community for TNBC Day will go to support TNBC-specific research. And finally, it goes without saying that medical research is extremely important to our foundation. We not only support cutting-edge research at leading medical institutions, but we work hard to inform you, our TNBC community, about any new developments in the area. We have expert scientific bloggers at all the major medical conferences, including at ASCO, AACR, and SABCS, and they work to provide our community with up-to-the-minute updates on new and emerging research and treatment options. So if you're interested in receiving these updates, please follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and we will next be blogging from SABCS in December. So we hope to connect with you all soon, whether on social media, by phone, online at tnbcfoundation.org, or live at one of the many TNBC Day events this March. Once again, thank you so much for joining us, and I'll now turn the program back to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Haley. That was really wonderful and such a wonderful resource, and your dedication to the triple negative breast cancer community with all that you've done through the foundation. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Stacey Lewis. Ms. Lewis is an oncology social worker. She's our Women's Cancers Program Coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Lewis will address the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation helpline and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Lewis.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. I'm also very happy to be part of this program today. So as the Women's Cancers Program Coordinator here at Cancer Care, I work with many women diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer and their families. Today we've been hearing about managing your care and quality of life, and I'd like to talk a little bit about how the TNBC Helpline and Cancer Care can be part of your support system. The Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation and Cancer Care have partnered together to ensure that those with TNBC have access to free psychosocial services and support. The Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation Helpline, which is generously funded by the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, provides callers with access to comprehensive services, including one-on-one counseling, which is offered face-to-face in our New York City area, as well as over the phone nationally, TNBC-specific support groups online, education and reading materials, and limited financial support. By calling the hotline, individuals are connected with an oncology social worker trained in TNBC and the physical, emotional, and practical issues surrounding this diagnosis. Our licensed master's-level oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis affects not just the individual, but their entire family and support system. We are aware of how the financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact that TNBC has on the individual and family. Adjusting to and finding ways of coping with your diagnosis can be an important part of the healing process. So we want you to know that asking for help, whether you are a patient, caregiver, or family member, is a sign of strength. You do not have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group can be a way of connecting with others who are going through a similar experience and are likely encountering similar problems. Individual counseling can provide a space that is just yours to voice concern and navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. These connections can help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer and their loved ones experience. And feeling well emotionally can ultimately help you better deal with your treatments. I also wanted to mention today that we are currently running a dedicated TNBC online support group, which is currently accepting new members. If you're interested in learning more about our online support group or any of the free support services I've mentioned, I would encourage you to call the TNBC helpline at 877-880-8622 to speak with an oncology social worker. We've learned a lot from today's program, and there's certainly a good deal of information to digest. Our social workers can help you understand what that means for you and your loved ones. Again, please do not hesitate to reach out to us at 877-880-8622 so that you can access the services of the TNBC helpline. And again, please remember that you are not alone. Thank you so much for your attention and for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Lewis. That was really excellent. And now we do have time for questions. We really have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question at the end of the call, I will give you all direction in terms of how to get your questions that you didn't get to ask or that you might have in the future answered. So, Candace?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Lynn F. Your line is now open.
Thank you so much. It's a great conference. I don't think I've ever heard Dr. Pahala speak before. My particular question pertains to metaplastic spindle cell triple negative. I didn't hear any mention of them, and we really need to better understand out here in the community how to approach these very, very rare but aggressive cancers.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Good to have you on the call. And Dr. Pahala, could you address that question?
Sure. The major issues with the metaplastic subtype of triple negative is, number one, they're extremely rare. So these are typically less than 1% of all cancers. So unfortunately, we end up treating metaplastic triple negative disease like it's triple negative disease because you're already looking at a rare subtype of a less common subtype. So there's not as much specific data on this group. You know, I think that I completely echo your sentiments that it is extremely important to have more data. I think what we'll need to really do from a consortium standpoint is to put a lot of groups together to look at studying these metaplastic cancers more. I am not specifically aware myself. I think historically maybe just a handful of clinical trials have looked at this group. And then hopefully as we're becoming more genomically aware of different subtypes of disease, and perhaps this is something that we can start to look more at as its own entity. But unfortunately, it's one of those situations where it's rare enough that it's hard to be able to study it completely.
Well, thank you, Lynn, for identifying this, and actually, and for Dr. Pahala for addressing it and bringing it to everyone's attention, and indeed the need for greater research on this. So thank you. And our next question comes from Melissa, from one of our online participants. Can one of the speakers talk a bit about the ongoing research discussion about the role of Lynch syndrome in breast cancer? Dr. Pahala, Dr. Newman, could you address this question about Lynch syndrome and
the hereditary susceptibility?
Yes, because the person, that was a very, it's a long email, but it actually be online, but there is a family history of Lynch syndrome with breast cancer in the family, ovarian as well.
Yes, so Lynch syndrome, and Dr. Pahala will probably want to comment on this as well, is a hereditary susceptibility syndrome where
members of the families who carry this mutation are at risk for a number of diverse different breast cancers. Breast cancer is one of them, but we also see unusual patterns of cancer called sarcomas. They will sometimes have colon cancer, lung cancer, a variety of cancers run in these families.
And Dr. Pahala, do you want to comment as well?
And you know, it's interesting that this question comes up because this is something that we talk about at our breast conference as well. I think that the question is very astute. And while historically we think of Lynch cancers as being colon and uterine related, there do appear to be some Lynch families who do have breast cancer. So I think, unfortunately, and I hate to give this answer twice, this is an area where we need more research.
So this is important for everyone to hear, the need for greater research, the need for you to have conversations with your physicians about this as well, your treating healthcare team, and obviously a need for us to begin to look at these both two rare situations in terms of doing more programming on this as well, in terms of bringing more information to people. And we have another question from one of our online participants. So it was kind of mentioned, but asking for a little bit more on the research and immunotherapy in terms of triple negative breast cancer. And Dr. Pahala, could you address that?
Sure. So the issues where we think about triple negative and immunotherapy is when we look at kind of a couple different rationales, one of which is that there appears to be a specific immunomodulatory triple negative subtype is number one. Number two is pathologists have identified these tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, or TILs, in a greater percentage of some breast cancers compared to non-breast cancers, and then also something called PD-L1 expression. So these drugs that we're kind of really excited about with immunotherapy now are what we call checkpoint inhibitors. So there's this interaction between PD-L1, which is a ligand for the PD, which is the programmed death antigen on the cancer cells, that then goes and interacts with the kind of equivalent receptor, if you will, on the T cells. So some folks have looked at PD-L1 expression in tumors. Now, what's interesting about that is that it appears to be an important factor in lung cancer response to immunotherapy, does not appear to be important in melanoma response to immunotherapy. And in breast cancer, we're really too soon to know how important this is. So as of right now, the published data, the data that has been presented at meetings like ASCO and San Antonio, shows that single-agent immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy, and really the ones that have been looked at in breast cancer are the pembrolizumab, which is Keytruda is the brand name of it, avelumab, and atezolizumab. These agents probably work somewhere between 2 to 20% of patients who receive them, although it does appear that those tumors that have the PD-L1 expression have a higher likelihood of response, at least to avelumab, which is one of these checkpoint inhibitors. Also, a recent kind of very interesting study combined atezolizumab with chemotherapy, and that appeared to improve the responses. So the idea is that perhaps if you have greater antigen exposure, which is basically kind of these chewed up cancer cells from chemotherapy or this DNA that's released, that's something that then the immune system can target. Because again, kind of the issue at its heart is that the immune system needs to realize that cancer is something that should not be there. And there's these complex interactions between the immune system and the tumor cells that basically lead to what we call immune tolerance, which is that the immune system becomes tolerant of the cancer. So what these immunotherapy drugs are doing are removing that tolerance and really helping to stimulate the immune response. Now, there are a number of studies that are being planned, both in early-stage patients, in late-stage patients. These are many things that are not necessarily out there in terms of prime time yet, but this is something where for those patients who have triple-negative disease, particularly those with advanced triple-negative disease, to ask your oncologist about, to look at clinicaltrials.gov and see what clinical trials are popping up. Occasionally we will get asked to prescribe immunotherapy off-study. And that's probably something that you'll hear different answers from different oncologists about. I think the truth of the matter is is we don't have a lot of data beyond phase one data at this standpoint. I suspect that there's going to be specific subtypes of triple negative disease that are going to respond better to immunotherapy. So I think when we do things off study, then you can't really ever find out why something did or didn't work. So I do encourage people to really focus on this as far as a clinical trial perspective goes. But I think this is something that we're really excited about as investigators and really interested to try to catch up to some of the other cancers for which immunotherapy has really been a game changer.
Well, thank you. And there's another question from Ellen, online question. Interested in finding out about care after chemotherapy and mastectomy in the first year of diagnosis. What do I do next? So I'm actually going to ask both Dr. Newman and Dr. Pohala to address it. So Dr. Newman, do you want to just speak first about just after mastectomy in that first year?
Sure. So the surgeons and the radiations together, we tend to focus on what we call local regional control of the disease, meaning looking for any evidence of cancer on the chest wall, in the front, or in the underarm area. So seeing the surgeon and or the radiation doctor on a yearly basis is always important for that chest wall examination. Seeing the medical oncologist at more frequent intervals is usually necessary, and I'll let Dr. Pohala talk about the medical oncology schedule.
So as far as patients who have finished up their chemotherapy, their surgery, their radiation, it's what we call kind of the surveillance time frame or the active surveillance. And in most circumstances, that's going to be meeting with your medical oncologist probably every 3 to 4 months, sometimes even 6 months, to assess for risk of recurrence. And generally, that's going to be history and physical, which is assessing someone's symptoms and doing a physical exam. There are a number of circumstances where there is not any role for additional imaging. And usually that's surprising to patients. You know, why am I not getting PET scans or CAT scans or bone scans? And for many patients, the reason why we do that is because it's not been shown to be helpful on a large scale. Now, of course, there's going to be case-by-case exceptions to that, and I would encourage everyone who's on the call to have that discussion with their physician. The other thing that I'd like to stress is that we know that lifestyle is important. It gets a lot of information with this with ER positive disease, but it's important in triple negative disease as well. And those are things like trying to get a normal BMI. Those are things like exercising 4 hours a week. Some of the healthy lifestyle things that can also help to reduce the risk of recurrence. I know it's frustrating for patients who have triple negative disease to not be able to take something like tamoxifen or not to be able to take something like Herceptin over the long term. But I do try to stress to my patients that those lifestyle changes are something that you can think of as medicine to help to prevent recurrence as well.
Excellent. And just one last question. What has studies shown regarding young versus older women undergoing chemotherapy with triple negative breast cancer? It's a question that comes up a lot in our programs, and here we have again. So Dr. Pohala, could you address it? I'm going to ask also Dr. Newman to comment it as well, just in terms of surgery, but in terms of old versus different age, does age make a difference in terms of undergoing chemotherapy was the question, but we'll also ask about surgery as well.
Sure. So I think there's a number of different ways to approach the question of age and chemotherapy. I think one thing I do want to mention is that typically triple negative disease recurs right away or not at all. So it's not like ER positive disease where somebody may not have a recurrence for 10 or 15 years. So if they're 80 years old now, then that would potentially be something that would be less relevant with time. So I do think that it's something to think of as you need to look at someone's health over the next 5 years in terms of planning your approach. There is the data that we have looking at young versus old women, and unfortunately, there had been a period of time where older women were not as commonly included in clinical trials, so we don't have as much data. But the data that we have, it really depends more on comorbidities than age as an absolute number. So I think that if you're looking at a patient who is relatively modest comorbidities, meaning that the person is not diabetic, the person does not have a history of heart disease, the person does not have high blood pressure or any of those other issues that might be limiting, then I do think it's reasonable to consider treatment. There was an older study done probably about, 5 to 10 years ago now, which looked at breast cancer in general, giving older women kind of what we thought of at the time as kindler, gentler chemotherapy compared to standard, and actually showed that there was that those women had worse outcome when they got less chemo because, number one, it didn't work as well for the cancer, and number two, people actually tolerated the stronger chemotherapy just as well. So I do think that there are many circumstances where older women with triple-negative disease, provided that they have a good general health and good stamina, are going to be treated pretty similar to younger women.
Thank you. And Dr. Newman, do you want to address this as well, just from a surgical perspective?
Sure. The surgical management approaches would be pretty much the same for younger patients and older patients, and we actually tend to want to be aggressive with the surgical and or radiation treatments at both ends of the spectrum for a couple of reasons. With younger patients, the risk of having a recurrence on the chest wall tends to be higher, so we do want to make sure that we've evaluated and managed the disease aggressively. And for older patients, there are fewer options available to control the disease on the chest wall, in the breast, and in the underarm area, aside from surgery and radiation. With hormone receptor-positive breast cancers and HER2-new-positive breast cancers, the endocrine therapy and the HER2-new-targeted medical therapies will contribute to control of tumors on the chest wall, and so sometimes older patients with those types of tumors can either avoid the radiation or have more limited surgery. But with triple negatives, we really have to rely upon surgery to control the disease on the chest wall.
I want to thank you very much. I want to thank our speakers. You've been outstanding on this call, really amazing. I want to thank all of you who've been listening, who've asked great questions both on the phone and online. And I do want to remind you, this is a one-hour workshop. We did go over a bit today because we really had some really important late-breaking questions to take. And I know we did not take all of your questions. So I just want to remind all of you that if you have a medically focused question at this point, I do recommend for any medical questions that you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Again, 1-800-422-6237. And their information specialists are really primed to answer your questions after our calls. They know when they occur, and they're ready to take your calls. If, on the other hand, you would like to access services from Cancer Care's services here through the Triple Negative Helpline, I very much recommend that you contact the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation Helpline, 1-877-880-TNBC or 8622. So that's 1-877-880-8622, and that will be in all the information we send to you after the program today. Also, I do want to remind all of you that we have another program in October on living with metastatic breast cancer on October 27th from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time for those of you who might be interested in that program as well. And also, as we conclude, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in living with triple-negative breast cancer and living with cancer in general. I want you to now know that you're part of the cancer care community world and that you actually can contact us at any time at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673 for the whole host of services that we offer, from practical and financial assistance to all kinds of counseling services to publications and these type of workshops. And, of course, the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation Helpline. So I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for staying the course with us and being on the call today. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may now disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.